from WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Whatever is weird, wacky, or wrong about this election season, you have to admit something fascinating is going on. The compass needles of both parties are moving. An outside-the-Republican-box billionaire is king of the GOP contenders. A Democratic socialist is getting a real mainstream hearing. The American people are on the move in some way. Politics is scrambling to keep up. This hour on Point, two big thinkers on where America's politics are headed. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you see the movement, something new, in one party, in both parties? Where do you think we'll end up? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now are two big essayists, one liberal, one conservative. Both have really fascinating pieces out in the new issue of The Atlantic magazine. David Frum is senior editor at The Atlantic and chairman of the British think tank Policy Exchange, former speechwriter for President George W. Bush. His article is called The Great Republican Revolt. He joins us from Washington today. David Frum, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you so much.
And with us from New York is Peter Beinart, contributing editor at The Atlantic and National Journal, professor of journalism and political science at the City University of New York. His article, also in the current issue of The Atlantic, is called Why America is Moving Left. Peter Beinart, great to have you back as well.
My pleasure.
Listeners, I urge you to go to our website, onpointradio.org, and check both of these out in full. Let me give you first, here's Frum's headline. The Great Republican Revolt and the drophead here, the GOP planned a dynastic restoration in 2016. Instead, it triggered an internal class war. Can the party reconcile the demands of its donors with the interests of its rank and file? So there's the kind of crack-up headline or something like it in the GOP. On the other side, Beinart writes, why America is moving left. Republicans may have a lock on Congress and the nation's state houses and could well win the presidency, but the liberal era ushered in by Barack Obama is only just beginning. Peter Beinart, can I come first to you? Many people may look at that and not be at all certain about that. When you look at the map of who holds the state houses, look at Congress. It's two terms of Democrats now. Historically, that gives Republicans a good chance at taking the White House back. Where's the evidence of a long liberal era being ushered in?
Well, I think that the fundamental dynamics that are taking place in the country still favor the Democrats. And they are the reason that Barack Obama won twice, and every 4 years, the members of the Democratic constituency, Latinos, Asians, younger, more secular voters grow larger. And the Republican Party, I think, is at the national level further away than it was in 2012 from having being able to crack those constituencies that it will need in order to win the White House. I think the Republican Party will do that sooner or later. I wouldn't bet on it in 2016, but it'll happen eventually. But I think when it does, it will be because Republicans have shifted to make themselves more attractive to these rising constituencies. And I think part of that shift will having to be coming to terms with some of the changes that Barack Obama made, that like the changes that Ronald Reagan made, which were ultimately ratified in some ways by the next Democratic president, Bill Clinton, that some of the changes that Barack Obama is making now will ultimately have to be ratified by the next Republican president because they are reflective of shifts that are actually happening in the country.
Let me understand. Are you making really just a demographic argument? New people are moving into voting roles and they have different ideas? Or are you making an argument that minds are changing about how the country ought to go?
Well, I think both, and they're related. I mean, if you look, for instance, at the perspective of younger voters, they are significantly more secular, significantly more culturally liberal, significantly less supportive of a kind of an aggressive military posture overseas. And although they don't trust government very much, they are supporters of a larger government role in the economy. And I don't think that the evidence suggests that that is likely to change that much as they get older. The generations of older people who are more conservative than now were also more conservative when they were younger. It's not always the case that younger people are to the left of people older than them, and it wasn't true in the 1970s and 80s. But it is true today, partly because younger Americans are more likely to be non-white, but also because they have been affected by certain things, for instance, the Iraq War and the financial crisis and the presidencies of George W. Bush, which they have a very negative impression of, that I think have primed them to be more politically to the left in the way that people who were affected by the presidencies of Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan tended to be more politically to the right for decades after that. So I think that there are big things which are changing. Again, doesn't mean that Republicans can't win the presidency, doesn't mean that Republicans will not be a competitive political party. They obviously are. I think it means that the Republican Party, to be successful at the national level, is going to have to make certain kinds of accommodations to the Obama era that it has not yet made.
Peter Beinart, I want to dig on into that. It's really fascinating. You've got many angles that you're looking at. David Frum, you make a really interesting argument or sort of dissection of the Republican Party now on that side of the ledger. And as I read you, you're describing a kind of crack up here where the Republican elites, the mega donors, have somehow floated away with their money and their messages from a very important chunk of the GOP that's driving the Trump campaign. What do you see, David?
After the defeat in 2012, the defeat of Mitt Romney, which came as a surprise to many of his supporters, came as a surprise to Mitt Romney himself. It didn't come as a surprise to me, I'll footnote. I published a book called Why Romney Lost 36 Hours After His Defeat. And while I write fast, I don't write
that fast.
Not that fast.
Okay.
After that defeat, the Republican donor community did a self-examination, both informally, and then there was a formal document that was released in the spring of 2013.
And you're not talking $50 donors. You're talking big donors.
We're talking about big donors. And what they concluded was the problem was not that Mitt Romney and his vice presidential candidate, Paul Ryan, had campaigned on a platform to take away Medicare from everybody under 55. The problem was not that they had planned to squeeze Social Security and other benefits and use the money to finance giant tax cuts. The problem was not that they really had nothing to say about the economic concerns of middle-class voters. The problem was just the only problem with the message was the one thing the donors had never liked anyway, and that was Romney's moves toward a more restrictive immigration policy. And so the consensus of the party was the article is full of quotes from important and powerful people who said this, people like Sheldon Adelson, people like Charles Krauthammer,
big super donors.
Right. People like Sean Hannity on Fox News, who said it on his radio show the day after the election. We preserve everything in our message except for one thing, immigration. We are going to go left on immigration. We're going to accept the pathway to citizenship or amnesty or whatever you call it. And if we do that, we will pull in Latino voters, add that to our existing base of traditional Republicans plus white working class voters, and White House, here we come. That was the plan. And it has run into the wall of Donald Trump, which was the base of the Republican Party, white Americans without a college degree. They are under so much economic pressure. They never liked the Romney-Ryan economic message. They tolerated it, but they didn't like it. Now the party has got an even more ultra-individualist economic message, combining that with a more open-door policy toward immigration as symbolized by the candidacies of Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio, and that is what has torn the party apart. It's important to understand – Peter said some very, very interesting and powerful things. It's important to understand when you talk about demographic change in America that while white voters under age 30 may in some respects – be more liberal. They are certainly more secular than white voters over 50. They vote exactly the same way. They are almost as Republican. They are plurality and even majority Republican. It's just there are fewer of them. So what we have and what is driving American politics, in my opinion, is the confluence of three big trends. The first trend is the slowdown of economic growth since the year 2000. The American economy has just done less well between 2000 and 2015 than it did between 1985 and 2000. Slowdown of growth. At the same time as the baby boomers are retiring, which means there are more claims on the resources of government, Medicare, pensions, veterans benefits, all of these are going to be ever larger demands on the state at a time when the state is going to have fewer resources because of the slowdown of economic growth, plus increasing diversity. And what diversity does, it makes it harder to adjust claims because the groups in society are more suspicious of each other, less willing to share. And this is not just an American problem, by the way. This describes politics everywhere in the developed world. Slowdown of economic growth, retirement of the baby booms with their claims on government, increasing diversity that makes it more difficult for groups to get along. And what you have is intensifying inter-ethnic competition. And so it's I think it's wrong to say the country is either moving right or moving left. What is happening is that the groups that are bundled within the parties, and that's true in Germany, it's true in Britain, it's true in the United States, the older stock inhabitants of the country grouping within the center-right party, the newer claimants grouping within the left party, and they are in a face-off for a dwindling set of resources as they make their claims on government.
But I have to say what I found most interesting, very interesting in your piece, is not inter-ethnic, but intra-party. Within the GOP, you describe a super elite in the GOP that's driven it for a long time with a lot of money and big ideological input that, as I read you, doesn't understand or doesn't want to know right. what a huge chunk of Republicans at the bottom of the economic ladder are thinking.
When you look at who Trump's voters are, here's what we see. They are they're not super conservative. Only 13% of Trump voters say they're very conservative. They're not, by Republican standards, all that religious. Republicans in general are more religious than everybody else. But within the Republican Party, the Trump voters are less religious than normal. But they are poor. They are less educated. They are much less likely to have finished college than other Republicans. They're much less likely to make more than $50,000 a year than other Republicans. They are intensely economically nationalist, and they feel very insecure. And the party has said to them, you know, hey, you're concerned about your retirement security. We have a great new plan to take away your Medicare. You're concerned that there are too many immigrants coming into the country. We have a great new plan to double immigration. You're concerned that we've had too many Bushes in the past. We've got one more.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about where American politics are going in this big presidential election year. My guest David Frum says the Republican Party is cracking up, the bottom from the top. My guest Peter Beinart says beyond all the noise, the whole country's, the center anyway, is going left. You can join us this hour. What do you see? Do you see those tides in motion? Do you buy Peter Beinart's argument that the whole enchilada, the political center, is shifting left? If it's shifting left, is Hillary a shoe-in? Sanders a real threat? If the GOP elite can't steer the party, what will they do? Will they stay the course? Will they reform? Will they lose, bunker down in the country clubs? Donald Trump has stood on the stage, listened to the other contenders for the GOP nomination, and said they're just not talking to central concerns of the country. Here's Trump.
And they say, the sun will rise, the moon will set. All sorts of wonderful things will happen. And people are saying, what's going on? I just want a job. Just get me a job. I don't need the rhetoric. I want a job.
Trump, down to basics there. And Bernie Sanders in the game with a very tough message on Wall Street that many Democrats have supported.
Here is a New Year's resolution that I will keep if elected president. And that is, if Wall Street does not end its greed, we will end it for them.
It's Bernie Sanders there. Peter Beinart, in the national polls, Hillary Clinton well ahead of Bernie Sanders. And, of course, the Clinton name, long associated with centrist Democratic policies, triangulation, the Democratic Leadership Council, free market, deregulation, and all of that. Are you saying that Hillary would be very different from Bill if she took the White House?
I think she would. I think the center of gravity inside the Democratic Party has shifted very substantially since then. When Bill Clinton was running for president, he never won a majority, but he won his pluralities. You still had a significant chunk of the Democratic Party coalition built around blue-collar white voters, and Democrats were competing in states like blue-collar white states like Arkansas, West Virginia. The Democratic Party coalition has shifted very significantly. Those people are now largely out of reach for a Democrat at the national level, but Democrats have compensated with the growth of minority voters, secular, younger, and more highly educated white voters, and Hillary Clinton is following that. The more moderate DLC Democratic intellectual infrastructure was also basically, I think, largely destroyed by the Bush presidency. The people who would have been inclined to be sympathetic to some kind of tax cut were basically destroyed inside the Democratic Party by the consequences of Bush's tax cut. The people who were inclined towards a more hawkish foreign policy were delegitimized by having supported the Iraq War. And I was the editor of a magazine that supported the Iraq War, and seeing the Iraq
Republic
War turn out so badly. Now, this shift for the left inside the Democratic Party may have negative political consequences for the party at a certain point. I do worry that there is not enough intellectual diversity inside the Democratic Party anymore as a result of these shifts. But I think right now what's striking about the Democratic Party coalition compared to the Republican coalition is that it is more cohesive. The people who support Bernie Sanders don't hate Hillary Clinton. They kind of like Hillary Clinton, even though they like Sanders more. That's quite different than what David is describing, where the people who really like Donald Trump really strongly dislike people like Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio.
David Frum, describe that. You put the big rubric on it of internal class war.
Right.
And you've run us through that, but take us through it from a few more angles here. It's really interesting. You describe this huge donor class, and both parties have them, but in the GOP, you describe it as really out of touch with the people who are driving the high popularity of Donald Trump, at least in the polls. What's the gap? What are they not getting? What was the old orthodoxy that's not playing to their base?
Well, one of the jokes I make in the article is that one of the more dangerous pleasures of great wealth is that nobody ever tells you you're completely wrong. If you hang out with donors, one of the things that you discover about them is they all believe they are brilliant political strategists. And they're surrounded by people who tell them, "That's true. Absolutely, sir. Excellent, sir. You're completely right, sir." Or madam, but more often, sir.
And they say that when they talk about, what, free market, free trade, let immigrants come because we need the cheap labor in our, businesses. And
They would say that if the donor believed there were Martians in Area 51. And as I say, it's a great danger of wealth.
Whatever, that
no one's going to contradict you.
Yeah.
But one of the things they have become convinced is that there's this huge constituency in America for limited government plus open immigration, plus free trade. And everyone
can I pause right there? Do they really want open immigration, or they just think they have to win over Latino votes and that's the way to do it? Or it's an ideological commitment to it, or commitment?
Now we have to be specific about who we're talking about. Mm-hmm. For some of the donors, it is a purely – and this – toward the end of the article, I talk about what can the Republican Party do. For some donors, it's a purely tactical or strategic calculation. I don't care about
Latinos,
immigration.
Latinos, we love you. Come on.
Yeah, much one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And by the way, immigration doesn't just mean Latinos. In fact, Asian Americans are the fastest growing group of immigrants in the United States now. And Latinos also are subdivided that Mexican immigration has greatly subsided, but Central American immigration is accelerating. So for some, it's tactical. For others, it's ideological. And for many, it's a matter of interest. Look, immigration, we often talk about it in the elite world as if immigration is the one policy that is completely cost-free, the one policy free lunch. But there are no free lunches. Immigration, like any policy, has costs and benefits. And the benefits of immigration are captured in the first place by immigrants themselves, and secondly, by holders of capital and highly paid professionals. People talk on programs like this, and people listen to programs like this. The costs, both economic and social, are borne by more down market people who don't get much voice in American politics, and who also don't tend to give a lot of money to campaigns and who don't mingle. So some donors do have a self-interested point of view. One of the people I quote in the article is the who's a major Republican donor, is the owner of a chain of fast food restaurants, one of the largest chains of fast food restaurants in the United States. He has a direct interest in this policy.
Of course, you can hear candidates picking up on this. This was Ted Cruz. The new TV spot running this week shows well-dressed lawyers and bankers and journalists as illegal immigrants are coming across the Rio Grande, and says everything would be different if those were the illegals, his word, taking the jobs.
The politics of it would be very, very different if a bunch of lawyers or bankers were crossing the Rio Grande, or if a bunch of people with journalism degrees were coming over and driving down the wages in the press. Then we would see stories about the economic calamity that is befalling our nation.
Boy, can he tighten that voice up and make it scary. Don in Whetstone, Kentucky, you're on with David Frum and Peter Beinart. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. Real quick, I wanted to say that Mr. Frum's analysis, I think, is right on the money. I was a Ron Paul supporter last time around.
So yep.
I'm not a Republican homer, but I live in a part of the country where it's all blue collar. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm a fairly educated guy, college degree and whatnot. But it doesn't really matter here. I mean, if you're going to work, you're going to do some blue-collar work.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And the past 8 years have been awful. The mining industry's horrible. Timber industry's a little down. And as far as manufacturing, while there are some manufacturing jobs here, the wages are anywhere from 9 to 10, 50, 11 bucks an hour. You try raising kids on that, you
yeah.
can't do it.
Yeah.
So folks see what's going on. I mean, you can't even I have two brothers, for example, who they can't find jobs because, you know, things in their past and whatnot, but they can't find jobs because they're competing with illegal labor, and they can't afford to work for $6 an hour.
Yep.
And it's a real issue. I mean, it's not a race issue. It's not a religious issue. It's not rich, poor. It's nothing like that. These folks are saying, look, we're here. Why can't we take care of our own?
So where do they end up, Don, when it comes to a candidate?
Trump. It's all Trump here. We don't matter. It's Kentucky. It's East Kentucky, so we certainly don't matter. Our primary is not until May, and we all know that. But, I mean, if you see signs and yards here, it's all Trump. And I think most people think, look, the guy's a blowhard buffoon. But he's the first one to actually speak his mind and say what we think in, you know, what 30, 40 years. Nobody here is going to vote for Jeb Bush.
Why not, Dunn? I mean, David Frum says people like you are really ticked off at the Republican, he calls them elite.
We're tired of blue bloods that say, you know, tell you one thing and you're living another thing. No one wants that. I mean, people here, they love Bill Clinton. It was great back in the 90s. But it's not anymore. And things have changed. I mean, the old Southern Democrats, they've changed over. Now they're Trump supporters. And the Democratic Party has themselves to thank for it, but they don't care because of demographic change, and they don't have to.
Don, we've got it, and I so appreciate all of that. I want to take it to both David and Peter. First, David, to you. Is there your proof point, David, right out of Eastern Kentucky?
Well, what I was struck by with the caller was that he acknowledged Trump's huge personal deficiencies and yet said he's giving a voice. And one of the questions facing Republicans, I end the article by saying the elite that governs the party faces a problem. What happens to an elite when your followers withdraw their assent, when they no longer defer, and they don't let you write the rules? And I said the Republican elites, plural, because the donors are a little different from the people in Congress.
Okay.
They face four choices. The first choice is to say, you know, what happened to Jeb Bush, it's a purely personal problem. He's a bad candidate. So let's get a fresher-faced person to say all the same things, like Marco Rubio. The second choice would be to make a tactical concession on the issue of immigration, the way the party made a tactical concession on the issue of abortion in about 1980. Before 1980, the Republicans were a party that leaned more toward the pro-choice side. After 1980, the party inscribed into the platform, this is a pro-life party committed to the human right,
yep.
Life Amendment. And since 1980, both every nominee and every vice presidential nominee have been pro-life.
So what's the tactical concession this time? What would that mean?
Do a more convincing version of what Romney tried in 2012 and say it's going to be the same party. We're going to have the same economic philosophy, but we're supplementing it with a more restrictionist approach on immigration.
Okay.
The third option, and the one that I recommend, but it's the least likely, at least in this cycle, is a larger rethink of the party's economic policy. And remember, you know, what Republicans care most about, the voters, it's not a smaller government. It's a government that's aligned with their values of work and family, where what government does supports the things they believe in, and where you have a social insurance state that doesn't seem to support destructive welfare activities, and that is focused on middle-class wages and the situation of places like Eastern Kentucky, that invests in not the soft support for government that we saw in the Obama years, but hard infrastructure, bridges, roads, airports, water treatment systems.
You describe this as true reform, and it's something more like an Ike or Eisenhower Republicanism.
Right. Put the center back in the center right.
And it seems to maybe support Peter, but if you went that way, you'd be in the Beinart zone here, moving the Republican policy agenda more toward what I think people would see as the left.
Well, I wouldn't put it that way because you
want to cut taxes less at the top. You want to invest more in infrastructure. You want to take seriously issues of nursing home costs and long commutes and inflated college tuition. I mean, that sounds more like what you hear from the Democrats on the stump.
But that sounds like what, as you say, Dwight Eisenhower and even Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford were talking about.
Sure.
We need to put Eisenhower's bust back in the pantheon. We keep Reagan in the pantheon, but put Eisenhower back there too. I don't think that's going to happen in this cycle. And the fourth option – and I think the one that the party will probably end up defaulting to is to remember, you know, the Republican Party down the ballot is a hugely successful organization, that it has beneath the level of the White House, the Republican Party dominates America in a way it has that no party has done since the Republicans in the 1920s. Big majorities in House and Senate, huge majorities in state houses and governor's mansions. And people could say, you know what, if the Republican Party, the donors could say, did all that on the Romney-Ryan message, maybe that's good enough. Maybe if the price of winning the presidency is to adopt a lot of Frum-style deviations, that's a price that is too high. The presidency is good to have, but it's not must-have. You can get done quite a lot of the things you want to get done without the presidency. So I'm guessing that
there are no concessions.
Yeah. There are no concessions.
Well, so far, but Donald Trump has a lot of things that he says which are not orthodox. You call this option change the rules of the game and essentially change the rules so that in the future, a Trump cannot get into the position Donald Trump has put himself in of leading all this. And in a way, leave the voting public with two options. Go Democratic or stick with us, i.e. the Republican elite, as you call them, and our orthodoxy, whether you like it or not, you won't have an option. We won't let a Trump climb up there again.
And change the rules of the game also. This is one of the things I said in that point. So the presidency is a weaker institution. The Republican Party was the party of congressional power, let's not forget, back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. It became a party of presidential power only after Republicans became better at winning presidential elections beginning in the 1960s. But the Republicans have been as bad at winning presidential elections since from 1992 onward as they were good at it between 1968 and 88. And parties, you know, just as the Democrats, when they started losing the presidency, became the party of Congress, so Republicans could do that again and become the party of the states and say, you know what, we will wage our political battles at the sub-presidential level where the Republican Party is indeed the dominant party.
Peter Beinart, when you listen to Donald Trump on the stump, he says a lot of things, and they can come from all kinds of directions. They are certainly not traditional Republican Party orthodoxy. Do you see him as representing part of this leftward shift, leftward liberal era that you describe, in spite of the many exceptions from that that are obvious and glaring? I mean, he sounds as though he might put a stopper in free trade. He's not about just cutting taxes. He talks about hanging on to Social Security. Is he part of your leftward shift, Peter?
Well, in some ways, obviously not. I mean, I think David has captured it well. Trump represents, and he's not a kind of economic nationalism. He's not devoted to limited government per se. Like a lot of Republican elites, but he's devoted to protecting a kind of the economic and cultural and even I would say racial kind of stake that some Americans have in the country that they feel they're losing. And he's not the first person to run that way. Pat Buchanan, let's remember, won the Republican primary in New Hampshire in 1996. We've seen, for decades now, we've been seeing this eruption of this kind of revolt from among blue-collar Republicans who are highly nationalistic, anti-immigration, anti-free trade, uncomfortable with America's shifting demographics, but people who want some economic security from government. I think what you tend to see is that the Republican Party is able to reel them in certain moments on the national security issue. After 9/11, George W. Bush was able to reel them in because his foreign policy was so heavily nationalistic. In moments when the foreign policy debate changes, then these fissures on economic issues become very strong. The one point where I might just add a somewhat different point to what David was suggesting, I think he and the caller, the more recent caller, I think there's no question that economic times have been very tough. We've not gotten anywhere near back to where we were in the late 1990s. People have not recovered. Ordinary people, many of them, have not recovered from the Great Recession, and that's what's producing a lot of the animosity that is driving Trump and also driving anti-immigrant sentiment. But it's worth remembering that this is only happening in the Republican Party, which is to say, I don't think we should draw too straight a line between economic anxiety and anti-immigrant feeling, because there are a lot of people inside the Democratic Party who are also feeling a lot of economic anxiety.
Peter Beinart, hold the thought right there. We've got to take a short break. David Frum, we'll be right back. We're looking at the big tides in American politics. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about where American politics are headed in this big presidential election year 2016. My guest David Frum says the Republican Party cracking up the bottom from the top of the GOP. My guest Peter Beinart says beyond all the noise, the whole country's the center anyway, is moving left, and we're headed for a long liberal era here. At least at the top, there is clearly a lot of tension out there within the GOP, sure. Donald Trump calling out the problems of this country when he announced last summer.
Sadly, the American dream is dead. But if I get elected president, I will bring it back. Bigger and better and stronger than ever before, and we will make America great again.
People laughed back last summer, but he is way up in the polls, and a lot in the GOP elite, as David Frum calls them, really scrambling. Now, Hillary Clinton out there with a message saying we got to have jobs for everybody. It doesn't sound as new, but Peter Beinart makes the argument that Bernie Sanders and shifting demographics and thinking in this country are pulling her left from the traditional Clinton grounding as well. Here's Clinton.
There is so much at stake. We need a president who can get the economy to work for everybody, not just those at the top, to have broad-based prosperity that gives every American willing to work hard a chance to get ahead and stay ahead.
Hillary Clinton right there. Jim in Omaha, Nebraska, you're on with Peter Beinart and David Frum.
Hi, Tom. It's not that I have moved so powerfully to the left as much as the Republican right has moved so far away from me that I end up being closer to the left, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. So were you a Republican? Are you now?
Now I'm an independent, but I am going to switch my affiliation to Democrat so that I can vote for Bernie Sanders in the Republican primary.
That's a heck of a swing, but were you really a Republican in the first place, or would they all call you a rhino?
Many years ago, I was Republican, but I think that some of that was related to my parents being Republican, and I don't know, maybe I was just more naive at the time.
Jim, I appreciate your call from Omaha. Peter Beinart, are you expecting many Republicans to end up in this leftward drift that you describe?
No, not that many. I mean, Sanders has made the argument that he can appeal to Donald Trump supporters because they also don't like Wall Street, and his economic message will be appealing to them. I'm dubious of that, and it goes back to what I was just saying before the break. If you look at the data on what makes a person have negative views towards immigration and immigrants, or what makes a state be likely to pass restrictive immigration policies, the data does not correlate with economic hardship. What it correlates with is partisanship, which is to say the single biggest predictor of whether you're likely to be anti-immigration is whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. The Democratic Party, there's a lot of hardship in both parties, and yet Democratic Party, certainly in the African-American community, for instance, which is in the Democratic Party, and yet inside the Democratic Party, it's channeled in a different way. The explanation for why this hardship is there and what to do about it is very different, and you see it expressed in people who support Bernie Sanders, but it's not likely, I think, to be compelling to the people who support Donald Trump, because I think for many of them, the story that they are telling does have a strong cultural and even racial component to it, which is part of the reason that they're focusing their economic anxiety on immigrants.
Do you see that, David? It's always been a big element, but somehow the cultural and racial here coming more to the fore. And even though ideological lines may be blurring a little bit as people feel the pain of the trends you're describing, it may not put them in the same quadrant politically.
Well, immigration has a lot of effects, not all of them economic. And I wrote a book in 2007 warning that this was going to become a larger issue for Republicans. And one of the examples I gave is an incident I came across where in one of the states that has been one of the most intense receivers of immigration, North Carolina. That is, mm-hmm. North Carolina is not one of the biggest immigrant states, but in the 2000s, it had the biggest increase in the immigrant population. Okay. And I met people who would have three kids. One kid would have started kindergarten in the mid-90s in a class where there were no English second language learners. And the youngest child would finish grade 6 or 8 in the middle 2000s in a class that was a quarter to one-third English language learners. And that had a huge impact on that family. Now, that's probably not going to be true to the experience of anyone listening to an NPR program, because we tend to live in neighborhoods where immigrants can't afford to move, and so our schools remain very consistently English-speaking in the middle 90s as they were.
You know, I have to step in and really push back on your characterization of our audience. You got to listen to this show more often and hear who's calling
in.
Listen to who's calling in. I think it's broader than you're suggesting.
Okay,
right there.
All right. You know what? Let me not make generalizations anybody. In the Washington policy world, that is certainly true. Central parts of Washington D.C. are becoming ever more monolithically white and upper middle class and professional. And the schools are also becoming that way. That is not the kind of thing that we tend to experience. Mm-hmm. And the idea that this is going on in North Carolina or in other places like that is very hard to imagine. I want to say one more thing about your question though about competition between Trump and Sanders. Mm-hmm. What increasingly is changing, driving American politics is not voter conversion. Voters aren't changing their minds so much as voter replacement. We have as the country changes, you have new kinds of voters who, as Peter said, gravitate to the Democratic Party. But what keeps Republicans competitive is that those voters have very weak likelihoods to turn out. So what you saw in 2012, for example, was that Barack Obama dropped a little over 3 million votes from the votes he'd gotten in 2008. Mitt Romney picked up from did only 900,000 votes better than John McCain did in 2008. So millions of votes simply vanished altogether when they were not as motivated in 2012 as they had been in 2008. Mm-hmm. That's the dynamic of American politics. You don't have a lot of people saying, Trump, Sanders, which shall I choose?
Mike in Franklin, Wisconsin. Mike, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. Yeah, I've been enjoying this debate with Trump. And the thing, I'm a lifelong blue-collar worker.
Okay.
And the thing that baffles me, when Trump first came on the stage, the first thing he pronounced is he was going to have this great big tax reform. And his big boast was, this is probably going to cost me more money. And then a month later, when his plan came out, all that was in there was a great big tax cut for Donald Trump. And until any Republican is willing to stand up for a minimum wage raise in this country, because everybody needs a raise, we got to go from the bottom up. The people on the top have done okay. And until that happens, there's no way in the world I could ever vote for a Republican. You don't care about our values.
Mike, we got a Peter Beiner. Do you see Trump's agenda, as far as we know it, quite apart from the big rhetoric, and it's very big, speaking to the actual need that you're describing, that David Frum is describing here? Are the people who are lining up with him likely to benefit from a Trump presidency?
No, but I think we have to examine what we mean by the word benefit. I mean, I think people do not...
Jobs? Vote. Income?
It's kind of, to be honest, hard to imagine what a Donald Trump presidency would look like. His policy discussions are so thin and incoherent. I agree that I think that there's been some class rhetoric that I think he's been the one Republican who's been out there willing to say what most Americans believe, which is that politicians are bought in both parties by very rich people, and I think that's had some appeal. But I think, his ability to cut into Democratic votes, yes, I agree, is limited by his unwillingness to support more populist economic positions like minimum wage. But it's also, I think, it's important to remember that lots of Americans don't only vote for which candidate will benefit them in a purely narrowly economic sense. People vote for the person who they think represents the kind of idea, vision of America that they want. And that's why, to go back to David's point about overcrowding in classrooms in North Carolina, yes, there's no question that immigration can create real hardships among Native Americans, especially working class ones. But they react to those hardships in very different ways. It's not a coincidence that Alabama and North Carolina are reacting in a particular way. They're highly, highly conservative Republican states. If you look at what's happening in California, which is a much larger percentage of Mexican immigrants, you're finding that state is actually moving in a more and more pro-immigration. They've just allowed immigrants to have driver's licenses, for instance. So
yep.
I think a lot has to do with the political culture into which immigrants enter.
Tony in Somerville, Massachusetts. Tony, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah. What do you see?
So I'm really interested because for Bernie, the Democratic primary this year has been pretty normal. Obviously, Bernie's very far left. He sort of pulls Hillary left, and that's what we've seen, obviously, in 2012 with Mitt Romney, sort of pulls far right, and then, you know, it switches on a dime when the election comes around and they appeal to sort of more moderate voters. And what I'm really interested to hear your commentary on with Trump is he definitely is going in a few different ways from sort of the conventional Republican base. You know, he's not, for as much as he says he's going to be huge on the military and the best in the military, he's one of the least hawkish in terms of, you know, removing Assad from power. And I'm really interested, you know, just in the fact that he's had two or three rallies just here in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. where Mitt Romney in 2011 was in New Hampshire at Tea Party rallies. It's really interesting, and I'm wondering if this is something we might see for more Republicans, is not necessarily pulling as far right in the primary and then trying to appeal more down the line as the election goes on.
Let me put it to David Frum. David, I mean, we've listened to Donald Trump make all of his promises about how big and great and huge everything will be.
Yeah.
We've seen the GOP elite, as you described them, freaking out about his great success in the polls. If it were actually, one way or another, a Trump victory, what kind of policies would you anticipate from him?
I don't know.
Isn't that wild?
I don't believe he knows. I still hold to the view that he will not win the Republican nomination. My friend Russ Duthat has a funny column this morning in which he says that to say Trump can't win, you know, something that was conventional wisdom and now has people looking at you funny, I still think he can't win.
Why not?
Because, look, 60% of the party does not like him. And although he does very well with Republicans who are not religious and who have not gone to college, a lot of Republicans are religious and have gone to college and probably rather more and with a higher likelihood to show up for primaries. But if you want to really have gas pain as a Republican, consider this. It's not impossible that Donald Trump could arrive at the convention with the single largest group of delegates, mm-hmm. but not a majority. If that happens, and then this gets a little technical, but understand – those delegates are probably not going to be people Trump picked. In most states, delegates are not picked by the candidates. They're picked by the party organization, because going to a convention as a delegate is a fabulous experience, and it's a great reward for people who have worked hard and volunteered. Mm-hmm. So, and they put them on slates. And not necessarily because they're so passionate about that person, but you know, the person who's worked hardest gets put on the slate that looked most likely to win 6 months before primary day. This yep. person who worked second hardest gets put on the slate of the guy who looks second most likely
to
win.
So what does it mean?
So when they arrive, they are committed to vote for Donald Trump on the first ballot, and that's it. They are not committed to vote for him on the second ballot, and even more important, they are not committed to vote for him on any rules changes. So the party could convene a convention where a lot of these people are like locally important people in their Republican world, and they change the rules to make it very easy to nominate a Paul Ryan, somebody who hasn't run at all. Trump then gets 40% of the vote on the first ballot, and then it's wide. That could happen, and that is really a formula for carnage.
Talk about your internal class war. That sounds like the recipe right there. Jen in Mineral Point, Wisconsin. Jen, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah.
What's bubbling up for me is love of country. And that Donald Trump is bringing out a very authentic sort of straight talk that counters so much sort of politicians' platitudes. Labels like sexist and racist and coarse and Republican, Democrat, socialist, left, right. His behavior is transcending all of these labels because he's speaking so directly to a segment of the population that is no longer interested in the labels, and it's just really hurting.
But you say love of country, and I get it. But many people look at that and say it's he's kind of pandering to a white disenfranchised group that feels marginalized, and so you know race comes right into it. Or is that part of it, Jen?
Well, it comes right into it if we let it. But if instead we trust that we are brothers and sisters with one another across the land, regardless of our cultural heritage or the color of our skin.
Yeah.
More folks are really in that camp than in that divided camp that many want us to perceive.
Well,
but it's not actually true.
Well, you may be right, though. When he described Mexicans, it was pretty darn tough. Jen, I appreciate your call. David, do you see somehow in all of this a way out of the polarity that the country's been stuck in or not?
I think that there is going to – look, everything changes. I think if Donald Trump comes out as a very strong force and if the Republicans then, as a result of the way he divides the party, lose the 2016 election, presidential election, while holding on to everything else, I think – we may then see the kind of rethink that we have not seen. I've been expecting since 2008 and hasn't shown up, where leaders in the Republican Party say, you know what, the presidency does matter. It's great that we hold all these governor's offices, but if we're going to be competitive for the presidency, we have to make the kind of adjustments that I talk about in point three of my Republican future.
Peter, does your analysis mean it's Hillary's or Bernie's to lose right now?
I think it's Hillary's to lose. I mean, she could lose it. She's not a particularly strong candidate. But I do think that the demographics favor her. Disagree with David. I think even white voters under 30 are significantly more likely to vote Democratic than older white voters. And I don't think I think that David has largely the right prescription for the Republican Party. And I think the good news for the Republican Party is there are a group of smart intellectuals, of whom he's one, who recognize the Republican Party needs a distinct economic message, not the same as the Democratic message, but a message that says that government will actually help people who are economically hurting rather than just getting out of the way. I think the intellectuals know that. I think that the Republican Party has, for varieties, not been able to find their version of a Bill Clinton, a guy with a political strength to basically take that message and break through. But I think that if you look at the Democrats in the 1980s, the Democrats had to lose three times before they would elect a Clinton, before they would make changes that now we take for granted, but back then were quite wrenching. For instance, Bill Clinton's support for the death penalty and support for welfare reform and for a middle-class tax cut. And so I think that it may be that David just has to bide his time and that the next cycle
here it comes.
We may see
Peter,
those kind of changes.
We're up against the clock. Peter Beinart and David Frum, both in The Atlantic, linked to their terrific pieces at our website, onpointradio.org. Our great thanks to you both. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.